Hi, I'm Mike Esnault, and welcome to the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge's AC23 Plus Artist Legacy Series podcast. This is a series where we talk to artists who are doing amazing things in the areas of the arts, including performance, education, production, as well as arts advocacy. We record this series in the Virginia and John Nolan Black Box Studio, as well as in the Jan and Bill Grimes Recording Studio here at the Carrie Siraj Community Arts Center. Be sure to visit artsbr.org for more information on all the great things we are doing here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge. Hope you enjoyed the podcast series, and thanks for tuning in.
Okay, I'd like to welcome our AC23 listeners to another session. I'm Mike Esnault, Director of Arts and Education here at the Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge, and I have a special guest today, Mr. Jason Anderson. Welcome, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let me do a proper introduction here to our listeners, or for our listeners. Jason, of course, is the CEO, director of Baton Rouge Gallery, and Jason, how long have you been doing that now?
This November will actually be 18 years I've been with the gallery.
18 years?
Yeah. Wow. It feels weird to say.
Well, we're going to get into the weeds, but you've just done so much for that organization, that facility, since you've been here, and that's really the reason I wanted to bring you on, just to let people know what you're doing. Most people do know.
Well, but we're happy to hear
that. A testament to what you've done. But let me tell the listeners a little bit more about you before we kind of jump into it. Jason has been there, like you said, about 18 years, but also 2022 was named 225 Magazine's People to Watch in the Capital Region, one of the people to watch. You were a member of the Leadership Baton Rouge Class of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
You were honored by the Business Report's 40 Under 40 in 2015. Fix me on any of these if I'm getting them wrong.
No, you're doing great.
I'm getting there, man.
Yeah.
In 2024, he received the John W. Barton Senior Excellence in Nonprofit Management Award, it's a mouthful, from the Baton Rouge Area Foundation. That's quite an honor.
It was. It was a real honor to get.
In addition to all of that, you regularly speak on cultural and economic impact of the arts in our area, and you just continue to advocate for the arts in every way,
mm-hmm.
and God bless you for that.
It's important. It's something I'm passionate about and have been for a long time. And I think the data and the experience that we've seen not only in Baton Rouge but across the country and internationally bears out that the arts are a major component in cities, in mm-hmm. towns, in rural settings, and can have, you know, obviously an incredible impact on quality of life and the way that we move through the world, but also from an economic standpoint and a city building standpoint. And as we think about the city that Baton Rouge is today and we hope to be one day, mm-hmm. I think the arts have an enormous role to play, especially in a state that is as culturally rich as this one.
Can you get any richer?
I hope so. I hope we can try.
Yes, we can. Yeah. We can. Yeah. But I mean, just our legacy and so many things that have come from this state.
No question.
From a visual arts standpoint, culinary arts, music. I mean, mm-hmm. the list goes on. It's amazing.
Well, and you think about all that has been possible to this point with the level of investment that we as a city and a state have put towards it. Imagine what could be possible.
Right.
The fact that Louisiana as a state is bottom five in the nation in terms of investment in the arts, I believe the number is about 46 cents per capita spending to support the arts. You have states like Alabama, Tennessee, Arkansas, Florida, all doing a significantly better job than we are mm-hmm. in terms of per capita spending. If we got that to a dollar, which would still put us in the bottom half of the country.
Right.
The amount of work that would create for artists, and the amount of return on investment for, this state and the experience that people have of it,
mm-hmm.
Whether we're talking about tourism dollars, whether we're talking about businesses, attracting people to come and move to Louisiana,
right.
I think there would be an incredible return on that investment. We have heard from businesses, you know, that they have an easier time of getting people to move to Louisiana or to Baton Rouge specifically than they do to have them stick here. And that once they get here, sometimes they have a hard time kind of planting roots and feeling like they are really part of the community. And that's really what the arts are really good at.
Right.
So,
yeah. So let me back up, kind of really back up to the beginning. So where are you actually from?
I'm originally from Miami, Florida. I was born and raised there.
Wow. So like what was, were you part of a, you know, vibrant art upbringing in school, or how did that work?
I wasn't, which is kind of surprising given what everybody thinks of Miami being. But I kind of grew up in a suburban part of Miami. My father was a roof inspector for the school board. He'd worked on roofs since he was about 14 or 15 years old. So I can't say that the arts or galleries or museum spaces were really a big part of my life growing up. I was much more into like debate and mock trials. And from an early age, I was going to law school. That was, okay. I had blinders on. I didn't try much else because that's what I was doing. So that's what I was laser focused on.
Right.
And I loved it. I enjoyed that world. And then when I got into college, I was a political science major because that's what I thought you did before you go to law school. But I went and interned at the state attorney's office down in Miami. I had a great opportunity to do that. Mm-hmm. And it exposed me to some of the realities of that work, some of the difficult situations that they had to deal with. And I started to have some doubts about it. I started to think to myself, you know, I don't know that I am equipped to leave this work at the office at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that that is probably helpful for me or a potential family or even those who I would be aiming to serve. But nonetheless, I was still chasing that idea. And in fact, from an early age, I had planned to be a criminal prosecutor. That was how I was going to try and make good in the world. And again, that experience being in the state attorney's office opened my eyes to a lot of things. But I came to Baton Rouge. My wife and I literally got married, went on a honeymoon, and packed a U-Haul and moved to Baton Rouge.
Why Baton Rouge?
To go to law school. My plan was to pursue law school at LSU. Mm-hmm. But I had not gotten into law school. There was some level of, my wife and I were both born and raised in Miami. We had only lived there since we were 23 or 24 when we got married. Mm-hmm. And it was time for a change for both of us. And so we came and looked at Baton Rouge in April of 2005, thought this seems like a nice enough place, and packed up and moved.
With the full intent of going to law school.
With the full intent of going to law school. We had a friend who lived here who was going to give me some work in their legal office, but we happened to time out our move to be 2 days before Katrina hit. And we actually left Miami the day that Katrina was passing through South Florida. And his family was hit pretty hard by the storm, and he ended up moving out of the state. So all of a sudden, we're 1,000 miles away from home, and knew nobody in town. And now my job prospect was gone. So I ended up working in the service industry. I waited tables and tended bar,
right?
Which is work I had done before, so that was an easy fallback. And about a year or two into that, I started writing for a local publication that was called Tiger Weekly, eventually went on to be called Dig. And it was really more of a hobby, but I started writing about bands and artists and filmmakers and had the chance to interview some incredible people. One day I got to interview George Clinton from Parliament Funkadelic.
Oh, wow.
So I spent probably an hour on the phone with him, and he is just talking my ear off. Right. And telling me how hip-hop does not exist without him, and Outkast, you wouldn't know Outkast if it weren't for him, and Dr. Dre owes everything, you know.
Right,
there's this ego-driven conversation that, you know, was a blast for me. I enjoyed every second of it. And so that night I turn to my wife and say, you know, I'm having a great time doing this. I'm getting free concert tickets and albums and and you know, getting paid to do it, if I could make a living doing something like this. And my wife, who's an artist, said, so don't go to law school. If you like, you don't have any debt from law school yet, you know, like if you're having doubts, if you want to do this, then pursue it. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did. And probably 3 months later, after giving it some thought, you know, thought what I'm really enjoying is the idea of being around people working in the creative field, mm-hmm. Making other people aware of what they're doing, helping them get their work in front of an audience. And so not long after that, I was working at the gallery. I started part-time. I was writing press releases and helping, you know, doing whatever needed done. And then about 7 months later, the woman who was the director before me, Amelia Cox, her husband took a job overseas, and I was lucky enough to be eventually offered the position after she left. So, so that's kind of the story of how I ended up in my chair.
That's pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it was a fortuitous road there.
Because, you know, I mean, you're so involved in the arts, mm-hmm. especially visual art, but all the arts. But your background really wasn't in that.
No. And it's interesting because I have to say my wife really brought me into that world, because it wasn't one that I had a whole lot of exposure to at an early age.
She's a visual artist?
She's a visual artist. She's a painter. She does work with graphite and paper mache and sculpture and all, you know, whatever she's interested in the moment. But I'll never forget, she took me, you know, we were starting to date, and she wanted to go to this art event that was on Miami Beach. Mm-hmm. Come to find out that it was the second year of Art Basel down in Miami, and mm-hmm. it wasn't quite the juggernaut that it has become, but it was still a big event. And so we're walking through this convention hall, and I kept coming back to this one installation that was by an artist named Tony Orsler. And he does all these, he's got all these weird shapes that sit on the floor, and he has projections that go on to these weird shapes, and they're faces. So you've got these weird, I want to say almost cubists, but they're not, they're more oval shaped or oblong shaped. But they're these weird faces making all sorts of, you know, weird blinks, and mm-hmm. there's sound, and I kept coming back to it, and it was the weirdest thing I'd ever seen. It was jarring and made you feel a little uncomfortable,
right.
But that's what I liked. It was the uncomfortable was what was interesting to me, right. And I kept coming back to it, and it always stuck with me. And she was not nearly as impressed or moved by that mm-hmm. particular piece as I was, but it was the curiosity that it sparked that was really fascinating. And I think that moment or that experience ended up leading me to the arts in a way that I hadn't had the opportunity or the awareness to pursue before that.
Right. Well, I'm curious, because it's obviously had such an impact on you and your life, and you've stuck with it for this long. Like, mm-hmm. Have you dabbled in the arts?
No. Well, people ask, you know, when we're at the gallery, people will ask if I'm an artist or, mm-hmm. you know, and I kind of make the joke, my art is bringing people to other people's art.
Right.
You know, not that I haven't, you know, drawn here and there and, put my hands in some clay, but certainly not in a way that put anything on display or that,
right.
that kind of thing.
Well, I'm sure you can speak a lot to the importance of that role, because mm-hmm. I know personally, like as a musician, knowing lots of musicians, and since I've come here to the Arts Council, because I was very much in my lane of music for my entire life.
Sure.
But learning so much more about visual art and dance, spoken word, all those things, and getting to know those artists. Artists in general need someone like that,
yeah,
to help facilitate their careers, mm-hmm. guide them, because let's say a visual artist, they're buried in paint all day, you know, that's their thing.
They should be, yeah.
But as far as the business side of it and marketing and all that stuff, that can very much be a weak point.
Sure.
And that's where you come in.
I hope so. Again, I kind of got into this field or this work to help those people do the things that they do, and hopefully alleviate some of those business or, mm-hmm. or marketing side of things. You know, it's interesting from a personal standpoint, it's interesting for me because I get to engage with and talk about and see the work of so many different artists who are working in different media, addressing different subjects. Mm-hmm. But to your point, a lot of artists, you know, spend their time, their education, their expertise, their dollars on investing in that skill set to, you know, be able to work with ceramics or work with stained glass or whatever the media might be.
Right.
And sometimes the marketing or business sense or all those things don't get the attention that maybe they wish they did. But when you have organizations like Baton Rouge Gallery or the Arts Council or others that can take some of that burden off, mm-hmm. and serve as a bullhorn, serve as a telescope, serve whatever metaphor you want to make. But the name of the game is getting eyeballs on the work or ears on the work.
Right.
And, you know, the gallery's mission statement, you know, can be boiled down to connecting artists and audiences. Mm-hmm. And that is what gets us up in the morning. It is what excites us. You know, when we see a first Wednesday or an artist talk and the room is full and people are excited and you can kind of feel an energy in the room,
right.
That's what makes maybe a quiet Tuesday afternoon where you don't have anybody in the gallery really worth it, you know, and it pays off in that moment. So,
well, you mentioned first Wednesdays. I love that event, and it's, you know, obviously it showcases the artists, mm-hmm. and their work. You generally, what is it, usually two or three artists?
Usually three or four. Depending on the month.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just a great opportunity to, it's a community thing,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just to hang, and you always have musicians, which,
yep.
God bless you for that. And you've really created an event,
mm-hmm.
out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But you, let's just talk about Baton Rouge Gallery in general, because I want to mention some of the programs that you have, and maybe you could speak to some of them.
Sure.
So obviously, first Wednesday, Articulate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Capital A-R-T.
Yeah. Articulate is something, it is a monthly artist talk series. Essentially, you know, we have the opening reception on the first Wednesday of each month. Mm-hmm. On the Sunday that follows, the artists are there to talk about their work. They'll speak about process and technique. They'll speak about the inspirations behind the work, answer questions from folks. It is intentionally informal so that people, again, feel welcome and comfortable in the space, but also can ask questions. That started 1 year. We had 1 year that we did Surreal Salon, another one of our programs.
Yeah.
We invited the juror to come and speak, and the staff at the time was just sitting there enthralled, and we're like, why aren't we doing this with all of our artists? Like, mm-hmm. This should be a pretty easy thing for us to pull together.
Right.
And it's incredibly interesting. And that spurred Articulate. It started off very small. We'd have maybe 10 people in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been doing it now, what, 16 years or so. And now you get, you know, sometimes 60, 70 people,
right.
you know, and get a good crowd to come and hear the artists talk about their work.
You must enjoy that, like having some longevity now with the gallery and starting these programs and just watching them grow.
Oh, no question. It's exciting. Yeah. And it's nice to see, you know, I remember when I started with First Wednesdays, you'd have some that were bigger than others.
Mm-hmm.
But you might have a First Wednesday that had 100 people and you'd consider it a good night, you know, and you'd have some red dots on the wall. You'd have some sold works. But certainly to see growth and see more people coming to the arts, coming to the gallery, different kinds of people coming mm-hmm. to the gallery is also really exciting. You know, it's certainly exciting for me on a personal level. I think it is also exciting for us as a city to see more engagement like that.
Right.
Young and old, different socioeconomic backgrounds, all of that kind of coming together, is certainly rewarding and exciting.
Well, you mentioned a minute ago Surreal Salon. So tell me, I confess I've never been to that one, but
oh, we can fix that.
But I hear things about this. I've heard it's quite an event.
It is. It's a different event. It is one that was started with the intention of being a bit different. It actually started as a one night only thing that was held off-site, and it is a show. It is based around an exhibition that focuses on pop surrealist and lowbrow work, and which, you know, can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But you know, you think of magazines that people might be familiar with, like Juxtapose magazine or High Fructose or others that kind of dabble in this world, and it's a movement within contemporary art that you oftentimes see a lot on the coast. You'll see in California or New York. And here we don't see as much of it. You'll see some, and I think you see more today than you did 20 years ago. Right. But it is a movement that is, I think, very exciting. And it has now become an international show. It started out as a one night only thing. The show itself was only open to Louisiana based artists. Mm-hmm. In year two, it became a month-long show that was open nationally. And then in year 10, it became an international juried show. We have had some of the biggest names in pop surrealism serve as the curators or the jurors for that show.
Sure.
Last year, we had the editor for Juxtapose magazine serve in that role. We've had artists like Ron English, Greg Crayola Simpkins, Camille Rose Garcia, who are all incredible figures within this world. Beth Kavner and Marco Mazzoni. And now we are getting ready actually for Surreal Salon 18 to come up in January. It is the show itself is always punctuated by a costume party, that is called the Surreal Salon Soiree. That's kind of towards the back end of the show, but that has really been something that, introduced new people to the gallery. Mm-hmm. And I think new people to the arts in general in our city, but, seeing how people have taken the opportunity to put together their own costumes and express themselves and not like go to Party City and buy a ready-made costume. They are putting together something in the house, you know, with their own...
The creative process.
Correct. Yeah. Exactly right. And seeing that take off has been really cool. One year, this might have been Surreal Salon 6 or so, we had a juror in from Los Angeles, an incredible artist who halfway through this event is kind of standing off to the side, and he's got this weird kind of puzzled look on his face, and it looked like he wasn't having a good time. So I go up to him and I said, you know, you okay? What's, you know, scared to death that he was going to say he hated this experience. And he said, no, everything's cool. I'm just trying to process all this. And it was like, okay, what does that mean?
Right.
And he says, well, in LA, this would never fly. It's like the costume thing for sure. Like everybody would be way too cool for school on that. And this would never happen in Los Angeles. And I said, well, you know, Louisiana and costumes, like this is kind of, we do this thing, you know? So that kind of made sense. And then he said, but the other thing is, in LA, you go to an opening or an event like this, and it's much, much more a social thing. And like, there's a social thing going on, and I see that. Mm-hmm. But I also see people talking about the work. Like, they are talking with one another about the work, or they're talking with one another about the costume, which is also kind of the work in the show for this night.
Sure.
And that's a really cool thing. And I was like, yeah, that's a really cool, you know, and it was nice that he noticed it and then pointed it out, because then it reinforced
it
for us.
Perspective on
yeah,
things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, and talking just now, you're mentioning, you know, national, international, and I'm curious, like with your gig,
yeah,
are you having to travel, or do you travel to get ideas or inspiration, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's important for us, you know, especially for us as an organization that has always been focused on local art, focused on Louisiana artists. It's important to be as aware of what is going on in Baton Rouge and in Louisiana as it is what's going on elsewhere, being aware as best you can of trends, of best practices, all those things. We actually, Kelsey Livingston, our exhibitions director at the gallery, recently got a grant awarded from Springboard for the Arts that allowed us to travel to Denver, and visit their contemporary art museum. There and their curator, Miranda Lash, just to tour the space and kind of hear how she put the current show they have on view together. While we were there, we visited another space called Redline Contemporary that was amazing. Visited Meow Wolf in Denver, which is certainly gave us some ideas for Surreal Salon as well.
Right.
But, you know, travel as best we can. We're certainly operating with a lot of programming and a pretty small staff. We've got a staff of...
How big is your staff?
Our staff is 4 people.
That's it?
That's it.
Wow.
That's it. We're about to add a fifth, but still, it's a pretty small staff given the amount of programming that goes on.
Yeah, it's a very busy staff.
It is. It is. In fairness, I think we try to do a good job of keeping each other, and Kelsey's probably the best at this, because we'll get around the table after a first Wednesday and start dreaming up a, you know what would be cool if we did, and then, okay, but there's only four, you know, right, there's only so many hours in the day kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
So we're good about dreaming things up and hopefully decent, at least, at being mindful of capacity and what's realistic, so.
Well, I'm going to throw some other program titles at you. So tell me about BRG at BTR.
What that launched in October of 2021. It actually was the brainchild or the idea of one of our board members, Philip Lafargue, said, why don't we have art in the airport? Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I mean, they've got art on display. And originally, I think the idea had come up once as a sales mechanism, as a way for us to get work in front of people with the idea that they would purchase work out of the airport. And the more we talked about it, the more we thought travel is a stressful situation. Who's buying work while they're stressed out and trying to catch a flight or,
right,
you know,
right.
Maybe that's not really. But then the more that we talked about it from the standpoint of visibility for the artist, visibility for the gallery, and visibility for the idea of art in Baton Rouge and kind of having people visiting and coming in. And the minute they step off the plane, they're introduced to local color and creativity. Then it made a lot more sense.
Right.
So we went to the airport and brought the idea to them and said, you know, you've had the same work on the walls for 10, 12 years. We'd love to come and refresh things a bit and change it out, at least on an annual basis. Mm-hmm. They got really excited about it. They actually walked us. They said, in fact, our idea was just the walkways in the two concourses. Then they said, we've got this other room that we're not really using. And it turned out to be the old smoker's lounge in the airport.
Mm-hmm.
So they opened the door. And as you might imagine, the smell comes pouring
it
out.
It was the real deal.
The walls are stained, all that. And they're like, we can use this. And so we went in and redid all the lighting and redid the walls. And now it is a dedicated gallery space. We've got about 60 or so works between that space and the two walkways, that switches out annually. Visit Baton Rouge supports that program and has since the beginning. But it really is just a phenomenal way for us to introduce the arts of our area and our state, to the visitors of the Capital area. Like I said, the minute they walk off the plane.
Right.
Yeah.
What a great idea.
Yeah. And we've actually had airports from across the country reach out to us and ask us about how we pulled this together. Because there are some airports, the larger ones like, I don't know, Atlanta or Chicago, they have art programs.
Yeah.
But they also, the airport itself will hire a curator and have a curator on staff to maintain these things. And so our setup where, you have a local nonprofit working with the airport, supported by the Visitors Bureau. That setup is unique. And we had, I think it was the airport out of Reno that reached out to us and said, we've been researching this for like a year and nobody has the setup that you guys do. Like, this makes a lot of sense. This, you know, and it's been a wonderful partnership, you know, kind of three-headed monster that's worked out really well for the artists and for the airport as well.
Right. Awesome, man.
Yeah.
Okay, here's another one. Movie and Music on the Lawn.
So Movies and Music on the Lawn started in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And from what I hear, I wasn't here at the time, but the genesis of that was literally throwing a sheet over the backside of the building and having a reel-to-reel projector up on a ladder, and they showed Nosferatu and had local musicians play along with it. This was something that the director at the time had heard about happening somewhere else. And she was like, well, I can throw a sheet over the back of the building and we can do it, you know. And I think we've upgraded our tech a bit. We've got, you know,
no more
big
sheets.
Yeah. We've got a big inflatable screen that we've been using for years and years. But essentially on the back lawn, 4 times a year, we have an inflatable screen where we show a silent film that is typically from the 1920s or 30s. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're able to find some more contemporary stuff. But the score of the film is then turned over to local musicians.
Love it.
And they are, you know, it's an opportunity that local musicians don't often get. Mm-hmm. We hand them a DVD and say, whatever you want to do with it, it's yours. And some of them will, you know, incorporate pieces of songs that they already have in their repertoire.
Sure.
Some of them are scoring completely new pieces for the film. Mm-hmm. They're timing out, you know, moments within their score to go with somebody falling down or something happening in the film.
Sure.
And actually last year, I guess it was earlier this year, actually, we showed a film called Hundreds of Beavers, which is like this cult classic film that was made in 2022. It's a hilarious film, but it gave us the opportunity, because we were talking with the woman who does the marketing or the, not marketing, the distribution for the film. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling her about the program, and she said, well, if you don't have the sound, you're going to miss a lot of the gags when these slapstick moments happen. And I said, okay, well, you know, it's worked this long. But it got us thinking, and all of a sudden we went to Clay Ashe, who's an amazing human being and puppeteer. And
tour de force for the arts.
And so I said, if anybody, we started thinking about, could we introduce like a live Foley artist to this? And, you know, a Foley artist being the person who adds sound effects to movies. Yeah. And I was like, if anybody in town knows who a Foley artist might be in Baton Rouge, it might be Clay.
It'd be Clay.
So I call Clay. Clay says, I was a Foley artist. I have experience doing Foley. And I was like, of course you do, you know? So he then got his old buddy Michael Russo involved, and they put together, I mean, this must have been a 10 by 20 setup with all sorts of different, you know, wooden sticks and bricks and balloons and all sorts of things.
So no pre-records that are doing
They were doing live Foley, and it was the first time they'd ever done it. They were petrified and nervous, and it came out amazing. So it's a program that, you know, allows us to do silent films reimagined by local musicians, and even now with some Foley here and there. But it's a program that we've been able to make free and open to the public. It used to be a ticketed thing. Now, thanks to sponsors, it is free and open to the public. Popcorn's free. So it really is just a thing that hopefully families can come out to, film buffs, music, you know, lovers.
Yeah.
But it's just a cool, unique program.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fabulous, man. That's just a few programs. I mean, you guys have so much going on. Is there anything that I didn't mention that you would like to mention as far as programming? Anything coming up?
I would say generally speaking, I mean, I think the programs we've talked about kind of give a good idea of the fact that while we're a visual arts organization at our core, that is the bread and butter of what Baton Rouge Gallery does, we also try and engage all the arts, at least to some degree. Mm-hmm. You have a program like Sundays at 4 that might have literary artists and poets, as well as musicians. But you've always got, you know, it's visual arts is the backbone, but certainly there's other things engaged with. So we'll have a Movies and Music on the Lawn event coming up in October, kind of a Halloween-themed one where we'll show an Alfred Hitchcock film called The Lodger, and a local band called Favorite Friend that plays at First Wednesdays a good bit.
Yeah.
They'll be performing alongside that film. And then in November, on the 7th, we'll have Kinetics, which is our annual art auction. It's our one big fundraiser a year. We'll have over 30 works that are up for bid, every single one of them starting at $100, regardless of the size or who the artist is. So kind of speaking to that idea of accessibility and it being a place and an atmosphere that's for everybody. So that is always a really fun night that does a lot of good, makes a whole year's worth of programming possible. So that'll be on November 7th. Tickets are certainly on sale now for that. And then again, January we'll roll into Surreal Salon, and the rest of the year we're doing our artist member exhibitions that are typically 3 or 4 Louisiana based artists at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll ask you a dumb question.
No dumb questions.
Does the gallery, rely a good bit on memberships?
Certainly. Yeah. We are, you know, much like every arts organization, mm-hmm. especially these days, always looking for support, always in need of support to continue the work that's being done. We're fortunate to have a lot of amazing partners in that are partners with us in a lot of different ways. The Arts Council is one of them. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out Breck, that's been a partner with us for over 40 years now. They're giving us our home in City Park. But a lot of what is made possible at the gallery is by membership. So you've got a community around the gallery that has been supporting it for almost 60 years now. You know, it started by 8 artists, but then it was able to be sustained by the community coming to it and saying, this is something worth supporting. This is something worth ensuring is able to sustain in the long run. And, mm-hmm. and it has proven out to work over nearly 60 years. So memberships start at $5 a month and go up from there. But it's a great way that people are able to support not only local artists themselves, but also a place that's been home for local artists in Baton Rouge for, like I said, almost 6 decades.
Right. And you've done so much since you've been there. I'm curious, from a facility standpoint, do you experience growing pains? Like, do you have the space you need?
Oh, my God, yeah. I mentioned being grateful to Breck for being an incredible longtime partner. And the building that we are in has been an incredible home for a long time. We've been in this building since 1984.
What was that building originally? Was it always an art gallery?
No, it actually started in the mid to late 20s. It was the pool house for a segregated public pool. And I say public, you know, for some, I guess, mm-hmm. Given the circumstance. It was actually, we did a huge show in 2023, probably the biggest show we've ever undertaken, called And We Went, that spoke to the swim-in that happened there.
Right, right. Yeah, you're reminding me of that. Yeah.
So it was this big 20,000 square foot pool that in 1963 there was a historic swim-in that took place that led to the closure of the pool. And that was something, you know, a moment that we tried to not only honor, but make more people aware of that history. Mm-hmm. So the building was originally built, like I said, as a pool house in 1923. Yeah. If you're familiar with the layout of the gallery, the back gallery space was added on around 2001, 2002. But to your point about growing pains, as we've seen audiences grow, and especially around things like First Wednesdays, we've only got about 2,700 square feet worth of indoor programmable space. Mm-hmm. So when you get, you know, 600-700 people or more out to an arts event, that space gets chewed up pretty quickly.
Sure.
So certainly, you know, we've gotten really good about using the outdoor space that is around us, assuming weather cooperates. But
well, yeah.
As you know, mm-hmm. South Louisiana weather doesn't always cooperate, but right. we've gotten pretty adept at moving things around in a pinch.
Yeah.
So,
well, you know, anytime your name comes up in conversation, I always hear, like, man, when does that guy stop? Like, it's just like, he does so much. And so, you know, I appreciate you so much. The community appreciates you so much. And again, thank you for being a guest again. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. I'm grateful to, I'm happy to hear that. I'm certainly grateful to the people that I am fortunate to be around in the building every day that probably make me look better than I deserve on that front. But everything keeps us busy, certainly. But you know, I genuinely feel honored to do the work that I do, and I am genuinely honored to be part of this arts community with the Arts Council and the Symphony and, you know, the LSU Museum of Art and LASN, all these incredible organizations and all the incredible artists we have in town that I think are genuinely doing work to make this place better.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah. Well, thanks again, Jason, and God bless, man.
Thank you.
The Arts Council of Greater Baton Rouge would like to acknowledge our generous sponsors, the Shell Corporation, the National Endowment for the Arts, the Louisiana Office of Cultural Development, and the City of Baton Rouge.